When they were in the Garden of Eden, they were as little children. Matter of fact, I got a story about a great-granddaughter about innocence. Apparently she was over at her, the two girls, Avery and Addison, who's 3 and 4, were over at their grandma's the other night. Cynthia was trying to get ready to go to work in the morning and get the girls squared away. And Avery started crying. She's a 3-year-old. And so Cynthia went to see what the problem was, and Avery let her know that Addison had hit her. So to smooth things over, Cynthia says, "Well, I'm sure it was an accident." And Addison says, "No, it wasn't." She didn't know she wasn't supposed to cop herself out. That was about as innocent a statement as I can come up with for innocence. But that's the kind of innocence that they had in the Garden of Eden. And then chapter 3 comes along and the serpent arrives. Now they've been told to stay away from the tree of knowledge. They've been told what they can't do. They've been told what they can do, as we know. And now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, "Yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" And the woman said unto the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die." And the serpent said unto the woman, "Ye shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." And then she partook of the tree. And then she gave to Adam, who partook of the tree. And their eyes were open. I'm going to start off with verse 7. "The eyes of them were both opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed the fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. And then when the God showed up in the cool of the evening, they hid from him." And he says, "Why are you hiding?" "Well, because we were naked." He says, "Who told you you were naked?" Well, the whole story come out, as we know. But from that point, in the history of humankind, we now have, and have always had, the job of being able to tell the difference between good and evil. The entire Bible and the Book of Mormon, that's the point, is to for us to be able to tell the difference between good and evil. Civilizations have risen and fallen on not knowing the difference between good and evil. People that turned out to be evil want to be good, then they prosper, then they turn evil again. People that are good prosper, and they turn evil. We seem to want to turn evil. You know, the Book of Mormon tells you that the natural man is an enemy to God. Well, that's why. We want to do it our way. We don't want to do it his way. But the thing about it is, what is evil? What is good? Can we look at the religions that have been down for, I'm going to say, the last 6,000 years, and use them to decipher what's good and what's evil? I don't think so. Because you take a look at what they teach, they take a look at what they do. You know, the main religions of the world for a long, long time, ever since probably, 100 AD, had been big, magnificent cathedrals and all the pomp and circumstance and all of this stuff. And that's religion. And that's supposed to be good. But then when you look into the inner workings of it, it's not good. There's more pain and heartache and subterfuge and double-crossing and politics and you name it. Goes on. Just like it does today. today, the things that go on in churches today are the same that it's gone on for centuries, because religions don't put their, I don't know what you call it, their intent, their focus on what's good and what's evil. They put on what's successful for them. You start off with, I don't know, back in the 1600s, maybe 1700s. I think it was the 1600s, maybe before that. The King of England wanted to divorce his wife, marry his mistress. And he belonged to a church, a worldwide church then. They wouldn't let him. So he banned the church from England, started his own church so he could marry his mistress and divorce his wife. Now that's a good reason to start a new church. I mean, that really falls under God's plan, I believe. I don't think he even began to think about the difference between good and evil when he was thinking about things like that. And that church is still in existence over there today. And it's the official Church of England. Nobody goes to church in England anymore. Nobody goes to church in Europe anymore. Not for the reasons that we understand you go to church. I think it's less than 2% of the population of the country of England go to church. And a lot of them have reasons other than for religious purposes that they go. Of course, we're not too far behind that in this country on why people go to church. Had 9/11 come along and all the Islamists popped up in this world, and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and now it's ISIS or ISIL or whatever you want to call them, and Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab and all of them. And you think, where did they come from? What happened here? Why are we doing all of this? And why are they having such an impact outside of, I'm going to call it, the Mideast? Well, they're having an impact because we, meaning the Christian community, I'm going to put it that way, and that's a pretty loose term and encompasses quite a bit, but we're forgetting who God is, and we're forgetting what good and evil is. They arrested a guy, an Islamist, over there in England, not too long after September 11th. And the way you sit down and talk to somebody anymore in interrogations, you don't get out a rubber hose and a 100-watt light bulb. You sit down and talk to them. And you're supposed to try to get inside their head, and you're supposed to get them to talking to you and get them to thinking and get them to thinking back and kind of, it's not a debate, but it's kind of like a debate. And that's just a real oversimplistic description. But anyway, they're talking, this British agent and this Islamist, and the Islamist says, they get on religion, and the Islamist says, well, who do you believe in? And the agent says, I don't believe in anybody, which is the majority of the Britons today. The Islamist says, oh, you got to believe in something. You have to believe. I believe in something. He says, you got to believe in something. Well, he does believe in something. But he hit a nerve, because that's the way the world's going, is not believing in anything. And they're playing on it. When there's a vacuum, it's filled. I don't care what it is. I don't care what the subject is. I don't care what the situation is. When there's a vacuum among society, it's filled with something. They say by 2050, England will be Muslim. How long is it going to take to get here and for us to be Muslim? Because we don't pay attention to what's important with our religion. That's the reason it's happening. I read this week all of this stuff with ISIS over there in the Mideast and all of the carnage and everything that they're creating, And they're really creating a stir in Europe right now, because by the internet and by some teachers in the schools, they are convincing hundreds of young girls to go to Iraq and Syria and wed ISIS members. And then when they get there, they find out that's not what they're going to do. This is Europeans. This isn't somebody from deep, dark jungles or somewhere that doesn't have any idea what's going on. These are people these are girls that are on the internet. And it's because we have forgot how to teach the difference between good and evil. It's insidious. It advances a half inch at a time. It's because of our disinterest or lack of focus on what we're supposed to do. As an individual, yeah. As a country, oh yeah. And there's where it's going. But it's happened before. Back in the 20s or 30s, you know, they got that big black granite thing over in Mecca that they all walk around seven times when they go over there for a celebration. Everybody's got to go to Mecca once, I guess, if you're Muslim. And as we all know, everybody over there fights constantly amongst themselves. And one of these groups likes causing all these problems over there right now took over Mecca. And they took that granite block, which is supposed to be the tomb of Muhammad or something, and they held it ransom. And I guess they got a pretty penny for it. And this was back in the 20s. So things like that aren't new. Things like is happening over there today aren't new. But we tend to forget what causes things like that. What causes people to go by the hundreds over there to do things like they do today? It's a lack of interest about the welfare of their souls here is what makes people do that. It's because they aren't being taught what feeds them is what does that. We have a clue in this church. How did we get started in Africa? How did we get started in most of the places we're at now? By the question, our church doesn't do what the Bible says. What does your church do? That was a basic question that's happening in many, many countries that we are now in, and we have a lot of members there. That's where it's at. You know, we got an email from some of our apostles here a while back that said that there's starting to be a pretty good influx out of the LDS church, because people are starting to understand the history of the church, because they're getting on the internet and they're reading things that they'd never been able to read before about what their church does. And they're dropping away. Why? Why do they do that? Because it's not feeding their souls. It's because it's not doing the thing that it's supposed to do, which is feeding their souls. How do you feed somebody's soul? Well, let me ask you this. What do you need for your soul? That's what helps them with their souls. Is what helps you with your soul. I've been traveling for a long time. Probably, oh gosh, I don't know, since mid-70s, I don't know. And I've been to a few places where we used to have locals. And they're not there anymore. And what I learned a long time ago is when you go someplace that you're new, you don't talk, you listen. And you ask questions based on what you hear. And you find out and you get them to talking about things and you get them to open up about what's going on here right now. In fact, I'm still supposed to do that, and I do. But in all of these places where there is no longer a local here, when you get to talking about what happened, it's because they weren't being fed the gospel. They were being fed doctrinal arguing. Every one of them had the same pattern, not the same doctrinal issue, but the same pattern. They got mad over this. They split over that. Some people quit going because they didn't like the fighting. Some people quit going because they lost the argument. And the two that won are left by themselves. And now there's nobody left. And everybody's gone. And then nobody wants to, or no, everybody asks, well, what happened? It's because we quit teaching the difference between good and evil, which is called the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's what happens. And we're not unique. People have been straying off the gospel of Jesus Christ since the beginning. Here, I'll give you a real good example. It's in the Bible. It's in Matthew. Chapter 5 in Matthew. And seeing the multitude, he went up into the mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. You see where I'm going? You go on down, let's see here. Verse 21 is where it really starts. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And so on. Verse 27, you heard that it was said of them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that, and he goes on and makes an explanation there. Verse 38, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And then he corrects it there. What's he doing? In every one of these things, and that's just three of them, but in every one of these things on the Sermon on the Mount, which is his first recorded sermon, he's quoting the Old Testament. He's quoting a passage in the Old Testament and then saying, and you're not doing it right. He's restoring his gospel. He's taking it back to what it's supposed to mean. So it's not just something that's new and modern that we deviate away from things. They've been doing it. They've been doing it since Adam and Eve. Look at Cain and Abel. See? But at some point in time, somewhere, somebody has always slammed on the brakes and said, hey, wait a minute. What are we doing here? To do that, you know, when we would have a problem. When I was working, we'd have a problem. You know what we'd do? First thing, you see what the problem is. You got to identify the problem. Then you go back and see why we're doing that. And then you see what you're supposed to be doing. And then you adjust back over to what you're supposed to be doing, which fixes the problem. What happens in a church that starts having problems? They're not feeding their people. They're not feeding them what they're supposed to be fed. They've got off message. They've got off track. For whatever the reason, and there's 100 reasons that they can do that. 100 reasons. And then you got to slam on the brakes and come back. Good point. 1830. It's exactly what happened. It's exactly how this church got started. It's called a restoration. And as far as I'm concerned, it's the only restoration. And the only reason I say that is take a look at the track record of everybody in this country at this point in time that calls themselves restorationists and see what they're doing as it is in these scriptures. And it's still going on. It's still going on. What with the LDS doing what they're doing right now and everybody falling away, there's already movements to start a whole new program, and they're doing it the same pattern. They're not taking a look at the scriptures at all in doing it. So they're going to end up the same. But they're going to have a lot of people snowed in the process. Many years ago, Martha was decorating cakes. We had to take one off, way off down south somewhere. We ended up going down Raytown, or Blue Ridge Boulevard through Raytown. We went by a little church down there. They had a marquee out there in front. And in the marquee it says, "Come Sunday and listen to the gospel of Joseph Smith." I thought, oh, brother. I would almost go to see what they say. Well, I was there for quite a while. Not go listen to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Go listen to the gospel of Joseph Smith. A couple of years ago, I happened to go down through there again, and they changed their sign. Now it says, "Come listen to the gospel of the RLDS Church in the 50s. They still miss the point. That's not what it's for. That's not what church is for. If it's a church of Jesus Christ, then it ought to be a church of Jesus Christ and not a church of somebody else. Of course, you know that they say that, and they tell you that in the Book of Mormon. So we've got all of these things going on. We've got this battle ahead of us. We've had it all along, but it's really going to get bad. It really is. Because we're in a headlong rush right now. So what have we got to do about it? Well, I think we've got to get in our instruction manuals and see what it tells us to do. That's these two books here. We don't have to create any new rituals or ceremonies. We don't have to come up with any new celebrations. We don't have to paint the church green inside. We don't have to put in different lights in a parking lot. We don't have to change our order of service around as far as the order of service, you know, like having the first song, one in the morning, and then two right after the sermon, or whatever you want to do. That's not the way to change the service. I mean, it changes it, but it doesn't change it to do anything. You change the service to feed the people. You change the service to feed them what they need. And usually the way you find out what they need is ask them. Get involved in a conversation with them and then find out what's going on. And get them to pour their hearts out one to another on what is needed. And not, well, I think that so-and-so ought to be quit wearing what he's wearing or what she, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the problems and the ordeals and trials of today and how to handle them as Christians. I had a gal, one of our travels one time, and these people are kind of militant. This family's a little militant. Well, she greeted me with, she says, "You know, the day's coming when we're going to be, when we're really going to have to take up arms, and we're really going to have to do some pretty heavy things about how to run our government and how to protect ourselves from our government." She says, "What do you think about that?" And I said, "Well," I says, I guess it's okay as long as you do it and you act like a Christian." Stopped her cold. She says, "But you can't do that and be a," and then she stopped. And I says, "First thing you gotta do is be a Christian. Because if you're not a Christian, and you throw away the things that are the gospel of Jesus Christ in your doings or your emotions or your actions or your decisions or whatever to achieve some end, you're doing it outside the gospel. So whatever you decide to do, do it, I guess, but you got to do it as a Christian, and only you can come up with that because it's your soul." I didn't hear any more out of her. So what do we do? In the book of Alma, Amalickiah went through a lot of subterfuge to get power in Alma in the 21st chapter. He ended up marrying the queen. And I'm going to start on verse 119 on page 477 if you want to follow along. I'm not talking about, this is not what we do to begin with. This is just a comparison. I'm going to read what we're supposed to do next. And it came to pass that Amalickiah had sought the favor of the queen and took her unto him to wife, and thus by his fraud and by the assistance of his cunning servants he obtained a kingdom. Yea, he was acknowledged king throughout all the land among all the people of the Lamanites, which are composed of the Lamanites, the Lemuelites, the Ishmaelites, and all the descendants of the Nephites from the reign of Nephi down to the present time. Now these descendants, having the same instruction and the same information of the Nephites, yea, having been instructed in the same knowledge of the Lord, nevertheless, it is strange to relate, not long after their dissensions, they had become more hardened and impotent and more wild and wicked and ferocious than the Lamanites. Drinking in with the traditions of the Lamanites, giving way to indolence and all manner of lasciviousness, yea, entirely forgetting the Lord their God. That's the enemy. Gives you a few clues there about what they are. They're lazy. They're ferocious. We know people like that. I know a lot of people like that in my job. There's a lot of people like that in the world today. There's countries like that today. So now that's verse 122 on page 478 where I quit reading. Now I'm going to jump down to verse 126. Now I'm going to go up to verse 125. Yea, and all the people which were in the land, the Nephites as well as the Lamanites, therefore he had accomplished his design, for he had hardened the hearts of the Lamanites and blinded their minds, and stirred them up to anger, insomuch that he gathered together a numerous host to go to battle against the Nephites. Sounds like Al-Qaeda. Sounds like ISIS. Sounds like a lot of people we read about in the newspaper today. To go to battle against the Nephites, for he was determined, because of the greatness of the number of his people, to overpower the Nephites and bring them into bondage. And thus did he appoint chief captains of the Zoramites, they being the most acquainted with the strength of the Nephites and their places of resort and the weakest parts of their cities. Therefore he appointed them to be chief captains over their armies. And it came to pass that when they took their camp and moved forward towards the land of Zarahem in the wilderness, it's looming, in other words, it's coming up. They're coming over the hill. Now it came to pass that while Amalickiah had thus been obtaining power by fraud and deceit, Moroni, on the other hand, had been preparing the minds of the people to be faithful unto the Lord their God. So what he did, he went out and he had a prayer service every other night for a month. Right? Wrong. Probably had a prayer constantly in his heart. Yea, and he had been strengthening the armies of the Nephites and erecting small forts or places of resort, throwing up banks of earth around about to enclose his armies, also building walls of stone to encircle him about, places of protection, places of defense, places of protection. Now remember it that way. And also building walls of stone to encircle him round about, around their cities and the border of their lands, yea, all round about the land. And in their weakest fortifications, he did place a greater number of men. And thus did he fortify and strengthen the land which was possessed by the Nephites. And here's the key verse. And thus he was preparing to support their liberty, their lands, their wives, and their children, and their peace, that they might live unto the Lord their God, and that they might maintain that which is called by their enemies the cause of Christians. That's us. That's just one place in the Book of Mormon. That's just one place that gives you a mirror image of what's going on today. So we're supposed to go out here and build all these forts and places of resort and throwing up banks of earth around and building walls of stone? Is that what we're supposed to be doing today? No. But we're supposed to be preparing to support our liberty, our lives, our wives, our lands, our children, and our peace, that we may be able to serve the Lord our God. So we have to have our defenses up. So how do you do that? Remember how you go to problem solving when I was talking about when you had a problem, you had to go back and see what the problem was and identify it and then see what the fix is by your rules or by the procedures or by the system, whatever you want to call it. I had a major taught me that lesson when I first took over and made the communications division there in the police department. And I was busy. I was busy. I was winging it. I had 35 people working for me. There was problems running all over the place. So I'd go tearing into his office, and I'd sit down, and I'd say, well, I got this problem here. And he'd listen to me, and he'd reach down in his drawer, pull his desk drawer out, get out the police department manual, and he'd open it up, and he said, well, it says here on page so-and-so, this is what you do. I said, well, that's a good idea, you know. So I'd leave. He'd put it away. Next time I come in, I tell him the problem, and he reaches down and gets his manual out, and he opens it up, and he says, well, it says here on page so-and-so, this is what you do. But it only took twice. So the next time somebody come to me with a problem, I reached down at my desk and got my manual out, thumbed through it, and I said, well, here on page so-and-so, it says this is what we're supposed to do. I was going to the source. I was going to the source of what our rules and regulations were. When you have a problem, and when you have a problem that's spiritual, here's your source. I have been in studies a long time ago. I have been in studies in this church. When I was new, I guess you'd say. And we would have half-hour discussions about what you had to be as a little child to enter the kingdom of heaven. And nobody cracked a book. Everybody said, well, I think, or well, I suppose, or it sounds reasonable to me, or something. And they would come up with some logical reason of how you were supposed to be a child of God, a little child of God. And it tells you, what is it, page 219? For the natural man is an enemy to God, and has been from the fall of Adam, and will be forever and ever. We already talked about that. But if he yieldeth to the enticing of the Holy Spirit and putteth off the natural man and becometh a saint through the atonement of Christ the Lord and becometh as a child, submissive, meek, humble, patient, full of love, willing to submit to all things which the Lord seeth fit to inflict upon him, even as a child doth submit to his father. That's what it says. We wouldn't have had a half-hour discussion on what we thought. What we should have had the half-hour discussion on was what each one of those words mean. Because I'll guarantee you that we'd have had five different ideas of what submissive means. And we'd have had another two or three ideas of what meek means and humble. But you also get those definitions from the same source you got this as what a child is. You get it out of here. And if you think everything's going along fine and you don't care, then you don't study about things like that. And then the next thing you know, you don't have anybody in church because nobody's interested anymore because they're not being fed. And then you wonder what happened. We've had it happen quite a few times in the history of this church. And we're not the only church that's done that. We've got a little church that, and I'm not sure what it was, it was the Church of Christ right up there at Gudgel and Hands, right up the street from us. Little bitty place, had maybe 30 people there on Sunday. Boy, they hated me. They would glare at me when I'd come down the road. And I didn't even know what was going on at first, but I mean, and they all lived right around the church. And then I found out that they didn't like me because I come to the temple a lot. And you'd meet them in a grocery store, and they'd just plain flat glare at you. I mean, there was no bones about it. Well, they walked around the neighborhood with their hat pulled down hard, too. And then the next thing you know, the church is closed because they were suing each other over some kind of a disagreement. I never knew what the disagreement was. Now, how's that for a church? How's that for the spirit of a church? Got a church in southern Missouri, not ours. Their preacher used to be a Dallas police officer in Dallas, Texas. I know some of the people that go to that church, and they ask him, well, why did you quit being a cop and decide to become a preacher? And he said, there's more money in it. And they thought that was okay. He's still there. How's that for a church? How's that for somebody that teaches you about the salvation of your soul? We had a sting operation one time down here in one of our city parks. And one of the guys who come in there made a pass at one of our stakeouts, I guess you'd say. It was a police officer, and he made a pass at this police officer. And he got arrested for indecent liberties. And when the guy took him up and booked him, he was a pastor of a church out here in Oak Grove. So they book him. And they send the paperwork up to the desk so he can make bond. And when the gal at the desk gets the paperwork, it's her pastor. So she's standing there with her jaw on the floor reading this about what he just did. And he comes up to make bond. And I'm standing there. And he says, well, sister, I haven't seen you in church in quite a while. What's the problem? You have to be able to tell the difference between good and evil, right or wrong, good or bad, whatever you want to call it. You have to be able to tell the difference. If you don't, that's what happens. We can be a country club here. Everybody get along fine. Everybody, you know, make the place warm and fuzzy and whatever you want to call it. We're not feeding our souls. We can get militant and mean and hateful and about differences of opinion we have, and we're not feeding our souls. Submissive, meek, humble, patient, full of love, willing to submit to all things which the Lord seeth fit to inflict upon him. You know, that was Christ. And was he some little wimp guy that sat over in a corner with his mouth shut and his eyes down? Like those words want you to think it was? If you define him like you said today, I don't think so. I think he told it like it was, but he told it correctly. He told it the way it was supposed to be told. He showed us how to do it. And too many times, people today forget how you do it. They just do it. And then wonder why it didn't work. Sometime back, down at Picayune, Mississippi. And I don't know whether it was a brainstorm or what it was, but I thought, you know, I'm going to make an explosive in church today. So I get in there and we get the service opened up, and it's there in John and Peggy Williams' living room. So I tell them, I said, you know, I've been thinking about it. I want to show you guys how to make an explosive. I want to show you how to make a bomb. And I said, I'm going to show you how to make it out of just common household stuff. So I got up and took off in the other room, and the thing I hear Carol ask Martha is, "You know what he's doing?" And Martha says, "No, I didn't know what he's doing." He says, "Do I have to move?" And she says, "Well, I don't know whether you have to move or not." And it's that kind of a conversation going on in the kitchen, and I go into Peggy's kitchen, and I start just getting stuff out of the cupboard. Sugar, flour, baking soda, just a teaspoon of this, a teaspoon of that. And I put it all in the bowl. Bring it in there and stir it all up, and I says, this thing is, from what I understand, this is supposed to be able to explode, and it's right out of Peggy's kitchen. You got a match? And they all backed up. So I got a match, and I lit it. Didn't do anything. The match burned down, so I got another match, and I lit it. Didn't do anything. And I says, "That's funny. I had this all figured out on what it was supposed to be and how it was supposed to work, and it still didn't work. Must be like we treat the gospel sometimes. We think we know how it's supposed to work, and we're going to make it work the way we want it to work. And then when we try it and it doesn't work, then we wonder why." Well, see, we get reminded once a month about this. It's called sacrament. This do in remembrance of me. How we're supposed to take his scriptures and how we're supposed to make them work the way he taught us to. I've been to a lot of churches in my time when I was growing up, and just about every one of them would have a big fancy table down here in front. And it was either, somehow or other, it was carved in the front of the table, "This do in remembrance of me," and that was a communion table. Why, some people would even read the Reader's Digest for the thoughts for the communion, because it was a nice, warm, fuzzy saying. But it didn't have anything to do with my soul. It didn't have anything to do with right or wrong. It didn't have anything to do with what was printed on the front of that table. They weren't remembering him. So why do you have to remember Jesus Christ? What does that prayer say? You're doing it. You're remembering him. Right. You got to remember him. Why? So you'll have his spirit to be with you. And you don't stop with your definition of that either. It's all in the scriptures. Every bit of it's in the scriptures. Do we understand it? Probably. Do we understand it as well as we could? Probably not. What do we study in our classes? What do we study in our weekly studies, I guess you say? What do we study in our Sunday schools? What do you study at home in private? I know I've said it before. I'll say it again. It's my mom. She was a good person. She went to church every chance she got. Nearest church was good for her. She read a chapter out of the Bible every morning. And I got to asking her a couple of times in later years, I says, "Well, what did you read this morning?" She couldn't tell me. But she'd read a chapter in the Bible. Did that do her any good? Not if you don't remember what you read, not if you didn't learn anything from it. Look at all the scandal that goes on today in the churches of the world with all this molestation and stuff. What did the Catholic Church here do when the first scandal first broke here in Kansas City? What did they do? They formed a committee, and they put it in the newspapers. They formed a committee to figure out how they could protect their children from their priests. Now, I got no problem with protecting the children from the priest, but you don't put it in the paper. You don't make it sound like it's some kind of a... You get the priest that you don't have to protect them from the children. We do that when we have a problem. They have lost their emphasis on what is the difference between right and wrong. We can have the most wonderful services. We can do all the ordinances in the most elaborate fashion. We can do all of the things that we can dream up and come up with and do whatever. But it doesn't make a bit of difference unless we understand what our religion is really about. I have an old history at home, and it talks about the Kirkland era. And it talks about the Elders College they had back then. And one of the things that they were teaching in the Elders College was how to wash feet. And they finally had to abandon it because everybody was trying to outdo the other guy with the fanciest towel and the fanciest wash basin. And there was more emphasis and money spent on wash basins and wash towels than there was on anything else. And they finally realized it was a waste of time. We know what Christ washed feet for. I've heard it and heard it and heard it in this church. It's not for show. It's not for some kind of ostentatious whatever. It's to serve one another. That's what it's for. That was the point he was trying to prove. Hebrews 5th chapter. I'm going to start with verse 11. This is Paul with a letter to the Hebrews trying to explain the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's what this book is about, the book of Hebrews. It says, "Of whom we have many things to say and hard to be uttered, seeing that you are dull of hearing." Praise will be talking to me at times. I just don't get it. It doesn't get in because I'm not listening, because I know what I want to believe, and I don't care what you say. Don't mess my mind up with my facts. My mind's already made up. That's what he's telling them. "For when for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God." And I've already address that when I was talking about the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus Christ had to take their 4,000 years, or I think it was, of teachings about religion and say, "You got it all wrong, because when we wrote this down back then, this is what it really meant." "For when the time ye ought to be teachers, ye have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and to become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat." What's the milk of the gospel? About repentance, faith, baptism, laying on of hands, resurrection of the dead, and eternal judgment. We all believe that. That's our principles. "For everyone that is useth the milk is unskillful in the words of the righteous, for he's a babe." So I can understand all of those things about our six principles of the gospel, and as long as I say I believe them and I do them, okay, no problem. We're supposed to. "But strong meat belongeth to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use, have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil." So we can believe these six principles of the gospel all we want to, and we can say we believe them, and we can practice them. But we've got to go on from there. This Bible is bigger than one page. And this Book of Mormon is bigger than one page. Why? Because of the many ways that Satan tries to use his subterfuge and his influences on us in ways that we don't even realize he's doing it. To get us to blur the lines between good and evil. To do the things that we want to do because that's what we want to do instead of the things that we're supposed to do because it's good for us. And that's what it boils down to. I want to do what I want to do. And I don't know how many times in my lifetime I've heard people take a passage out of the Bible and use it completely out of context to make some argument about what they want to believe. I think the ones that got me the most are the ones that used to do that defending spouse abuse. Bible says I can do that, but I'm in charge. But strong meat belongeth to them that are full of age, that are adults, and that are responsible, mature, perfect in the gospel, if you want to say it that way. Even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. That's my prayer that I can do that. Thank you.